Most of concern under this point, however, is my concern around the Patriot Act. The Patriot Act in the United States requires that U.S. corporations operating in other countries, they are required to share what may be vital information for Homeland Security with the United States. As you probably know, there was a hearing in this province by the Privacy Commission because the BC government allowed the outsourcing of its records keeping for health to Maximus Corporation in the United States. And the Privacy Commissioner and plus some very influential academics looking at this have all said absolutely there is no question that this material will have to be shared with Homeland Security, the Homeland Department, if there is concern around any security. What you may not know is that Lockheed Martin, the world's biggest weapons manufacturer, was just given the green light to create all the software for our census, the Canadian census. This is the company that designed the missile guidance system for the ABM missile. And I don't know how you feel about it, but I don't like them having my postal code. But they are going to be required under the U.S. Patriot Act to share this information with the United States. Third concern that I have is around energy and water, our resources. This is, if almost more than anything else, this is about resources. This is about cheap American or cheap Mexican labor, migrant labor, not the type of labor that comes and seeks refugee status, the kind of labor that's mobile, that can be brought when it's needed and sent back home when it's not. American power and financial institutions and Canadian resources. We are now moving into the Athabasca tar sands in a very serious way, and we're about to launch hearings, which are going to be shortchanged in order to build a pipeline to bring the gas to operate the mine to take the heavy oil from these tar sands and send it all, every single bit of it, to the United States for their war machine. Now, it's very important for you to know that this has enormous environmental implications, including for water. For every barrel of oil that is taken out of those tar sands, 3 barrels of water are used. 1 barrel is lost to the hydrologic cycle forever. It's a very, very dangerous project for us to get into. But I also want to say that it's clear that water is on the table. California has 20 years left. New Mexico has 10 years left. Arizona has none. Florida's in trouble. The Great Ogallala Aquifer under the whole Midwest in the United States is being depleted. There is no question that water is being negotiated quietly behind closed doors. Whether it will be discussed tomorrow when the three leaders meet, I don't know, I'll never know, and you'll never know, but I can tell you it's on the agenda of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, and it's on George Bush's mind. He said so several times publicly. And finally, my final concern is, of course, Social Security, which involves health care, education, social programs, every aspect of the Social Security regime we've built up in this country. The leading domestic policy of George Bush's second term is Social Security. He intends to take a massive transfer of pensions and other collectively held Social Security funds and privatize them. He wants to move them from a collective place to an individual responsibility, and he is well on his way to doing this. They are, as you well know, turning over, and this is mostly complete now, the running of health care to great big transnational health corporations, what they're called HMOs, and they have corporations that are so big in the United States running these hospitals and doctor's office and pharmaceuticals and insurance companies that they are registered on the stock exchange and are among the biggest corporations in the United States. But they're also turning over the care of education to corporations like EDS. And they're also talking about moving much more of social programs, social delivery, welfare, and so on, over to corporations like our friends Lockheed Martin. Again, the world's biggest weapons manufacturer is now delivering welfare in Texas and Michigan. And under the terms of NAFTA, by the way, you cannot turn around and say, you know, we can't have these companies here once we've been privatizing in our own communities. They're going to do it in the United States and Canada through 3Ps, which of course is already underway in this province and several others. But you should also know that Paul Martin has already adopted the 3P model officially. There is a minister in his cabinet responsible for 3Ps and promoting them across the country. And there's an active and powerful new lobby group on Parliament Hill called the Canadian Council for Public-Private Partnerships. And of course, this dovetails with the upcoming General Agreement on Trade and Services negotiation, the GATS negotiations on that are underway now and due to come up in Hong Kong in December when the WTO has its next ministerial meeting. Now, I'm bringing you a scary message this morning, and we've been very, very active in our organization at the Council of Canadians on this issue. We launched what we call a citizens' inquiry into Canada-U.S. relations, and we held this inquiry in 10 different cities across the country. And we had submissions from experts and organizations that were just tremendous. The organizations represented collectively millions of Canadians. There's a report going to come out in about a month, and it will come out at the same time, around the same time that this task force on the future of North America tables its final report. And we're very, very keen to have the two reports out there as competing reports, because so far there has been no citizen voice on this. This has all been negotiated by the big business community, a certain small cadre of political elite in Ottawa, and a small group of intellectuals and think tanks. This is you could put these people into the bathrooms in around here. That's how few of them there are, but they are powerful, and they have a lot of money, and they have the ear of the Prime Minister, and we need to know what they're doing. And I don't have to tell you, we do not have access to the mainstream media the way we did in the first round of this fight 15 years ago. We are dealing not only with a much more right-wing media, we're also dealing with a business community that's become sophisticated. They're not taking full-page ads out in the newspapers the way they did with the first free trade agreement. They're not putting out booklets. They're not telling you. They don't want you to know, because they know if you know this is happening, you will be very unhappy and you will say no. We're also putting together a network of national organizations in Canada, holding briefings this morning as we speak. There's briefings with MPs on Parliament Hill, and we had a tri-country media briefing session with activists from the three countries, and we had a tremendous group of media. Apparently, I talked to my office, we had a tremendous group of media from quite good media, quite serious, you know, big media from the three countries. Willing and ready to listen to our position. We did, and make no mistake, this was our victory. We did stop missile defense. We maybe not forever, but we did stop missile defense. And we have been enormously effective on the trade front. And again, this is quiet work that's going on behind the scenes. We not only shut down the WTO in Seattle in 1999, but we shut down the WTO in Cancun, Mexico a year ago this past September, and that you may not know as much about because there was so much less media, where the entire world's media came to Seattle and we were all over the media with our perspectives. There were only two reporters sent to Cancun, Mexico from Canada. One was with the business pages of the Globe and Mail, and the other was the business pages of the National Post. So when the head of the Kenyan delegation got up at the last moment and said, or the last day, and said, "What part of no don't you understand?" And when he walked out and the entire Kenyan delegation walked out, and then the entire Latin American delegation walked out, and all the Africans and all the Asians, all of them, and left only Canada, United States, and Europe standing there sputtering, you didn't read about it because they didn't want you to know what had happened there. So it was just a little minor blip in the business pages that talks would go on at another time. But actually what happened was the 80% of the world stood up to the 20% of the first world and said no. And you should also know that it came at a terrible price, because a lot of what came to fruition there was the issue of subsistence farming, and which includes water, but you know, the issues around healthcare and education were all important, but the crux of what the debate came to be was around the fact that World Trade Organization agricultural policies are throwing people off the land all over the world, millions and millions and millions of small farmers, small family farmers, independent farmers, are being forced off the land. And on the first day of the opening, we had a march of subsistence farmers and displaced farmers, thousands and thousands of us, marching towards the barricade in the highway, which was kilometers away from the resort town, of course, where the delegates were meeting in their five-star hotels and their golf courses and their swimming pools and so on. And the head of the South Korean Farmers Union, a lovely man named Lee Kyung-hai, got up and he stood up on the chain link fence and he looked towards the WTO where the meeting was taking place, and he had a sign on him that said WTO kills farmers. Because he was somebody who had lost his own farm. His valley that used to be filled with rice paddies is a shopping mall now for tourists. And he counsels other farmers and farm families, particularly farm families where the farmer father had committed suicide. And he picked up his sign, and he took a knife, and he stabbed it in his heart, and he swayed back and forth on the chain link fence, and he fell, and he died in front of all of us. And he did this because he'd come to the end. And I share this with you because it wasn't, damn it, in the Globe and Mail, and it wasn't in the National Post, and it should have been. You should have known that somebody died to make those delegates think about what these issues are about. Every 8 seconds in this world, a child dies of waterborne disease. That's the equivalent of 24 jumbo jets of children every day crashing. And in the United States there, George Bush signed in his pajamas to keep a woman alive who hasn't been alive in her body or her soul or her mind for 15 years. Is that the future that we want? Do we still want to stand for something different in this country? We have lost so much of what we used to stand for. I used to go to these international meetings and people would say, God, Canada's here. Thank God about you guys. And now they say, what happened to your government? A trade official put it beautifully. He said, we used to come into some countries with lists of political prisoners we wanted released. And now we come with lists of business associates that we want to be part of. We want demands for their market share. We don't care what happens anymore. Canada has changed officially. We are not the country we used to be. And this is the reflection back here in British Columbia. You can't have a government like this unless it's happening at some level nationally and internationally. This is not, you want Gordon Campbell, yes, defeat him, but he's the messenger, not the message. It is terribly important that we understand the struggle that we're in today. We are at the cusp of some important decisions. Globalization has failed. It was a wrong model delivered by the wrong people for the wrong reasons. It failed. The world is poorer. There is more poverty. There is more violence. And it is ecologically unsustainable. An American environmentalist said that the mantra or the notion of unlimited growth has the same DNA as the cancer cell. It has to turn on its host in order to survive. It has to kill its host to survive itself. While we are killing the planet, it's got to stop. The question will be what will take its place. Will it be regional trade and military blocs like North America going in and militarizing space and locking ourselves into George Bush's dream? Is that what we want? Is that the Canada we want? How will you fight what's happening in this province if we don't fight this nationally and at an international level? Our ancestors had something better in mind for us. They didn't do it all right. We made big mistakes. But they said, in order to survive on the northern half of the North American continent, we have to share for survival. Sharing for survival is the Canadian narrative. Survival of the fittest is the American narrative. And don't get me wrong, there are wonderful Americans who totally and completely agree, and we're working very closely with them. And there are many in Canada who have a very different vision and would be much, much happier in a George Bush America. This is not Canada versus the United States. This is about two different sets of visions for our common heritage in this country and in this world. And this is the time to get involved, because we have to design a better world. We have to design a better British Columbia. We have to design a better Canada. We have to design a better world. It is possible. That's the slogan, the mantra of the World Social Forum. And I just came back from my fifth World Social Forum in Porto Alegre, Brazil. We had 150,000 people. We had 500 workshops a day. They had to build a tent city to hold us all. And the languages and the music and the food and the culture and the excitement about what we were building was absolutely palpable. And I come back from that saying to you that there is a movement out there and you are part of it. And BCTF has been one of the most important institutions in this country, not just this province, and I'm not just saying that because I'm speaking to you. You have stood for something for years and years and years. You have stood up and against this other agenda, and you will continue to do this. They cannot take the heart out of you. They can take down some of your classrooms, and they can close some of your schools, and they can fire a lot of you, and they've done it. They will not take the soul out of you because you are the keepers of democracy. You're the keepers of public education. You know that in our system, every child counts, and that's not the world they're building. They want a world designed for an elite with either an egg shape or a pear shape. They want the best education and health care and everything else for the kids at the top, survival of the children of the fittest, and they want secondary systems or no systems for everybody else. And that's anathema to what you're about. I just end. Economic globalization is failing. What will we replace it with? What will we replace it with? What part will we play? And I'll end with these beautiful words from Arundhati Roy, who's a wonderful activist from India. She ended the Delhi or the Mumbai Social Forum last year with these words. Not only is another world possible, because that's our motto at the World Social Forum, another world is possible. Not only is another world possible, another world is under construction. And she said, on a quiet morning, I can hear her breathing. Thank you.